Welcome to Episode 7 of the Dean's Podcast, the podcast about issues shaping graduate studies in Canada. This podcast is brought to you by University Affairs Magazine. My name is Carolyn Waters, and I'm the Dean of Graduate Studies at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I'm also the president of the Canadian Association of Graduate Studies, CAGS, for the year 2009. Every month, you can listen in as I talk to other deans, faculty, postdocs, and graduate students about where graduate studies is going in Canada and internationally. In this episode, I talk to Ben Wynott, president of the University of Alberta Graduate Students Association, and Craig Sloss, the former president of the University of Waterloo Graduate Students Association. Ben, Craig, and I met recently at the second annual G13 Graduate Students Association Conference in Edmonton. In our conversation, we touch on the challenges of securing space on campus for graduate students, as well as how best to make the case for the importance of research funding in Canada. A very interesting conversation. But first, a message from our sponsor.
Hi, my name is Dick Sullentize, and I'm responsible for all career advertising and university affairs. Did you know that most graduate students don't know where to look for academic jobs? Simply because their supervisors haven't told them. Tell the PhDs and postdocs you advise to visit www.universityaffairs.ca for the latest job offers in every discipline. It's free and it's updated daily.
Okay, welcome back. I'm Carolyn Waters from Dalhousie University, and it's my pleasure to be at the National Conference for the G13 Graduate Students. Is that a society?
It's a group of 13
here at the University of Edmonton. And I have with me today Ben Wynott, who's the president of the graduate students at the University of Alberta. And I have Craig Sloss, who's the president of the graduate students at the University of Waterloo. So I'll ask you just to introduce yourselves for a bit. So welcome, Craig.
Hello. I'm a mathematician at the University of Waterloo, working on my PhD program. I've been the president of my grad student association for almost a year now. I'm coming to the end of my term, actually, so this is one of the last interviews I get to give, I guess.
Okay, great. And Ben?
Thanks as well for taking the time to speak with us. Like Craig, I'm also completing my term as the president of the Grad Association at the U of A, and I'm doing a master's in political science, and I'm in my second year.
So I'm telling Ben he should come with me to Ottawa. We'll talk about that later. So we've been discussing a couple of issues that we might want to talk about, and one is the SHRC funding with the business orientation, and we'll come back to that. But I thought first we might talk a little bit about this sort of general national trend for actually asking universities to provide space, quality space for graduate students. So, Ben, can you talk a little bit about what's going on at Alberta?
Absolutely. This has been a big issue for the University of Alberta GSA for quite a long time. I think we're unique among GSAs in the country in that we actually don't have dedicated graduate social space of any kind. Actually, we have the GSA's offices, which provide a limited amount of seating. I think the estimate that I come up with is about 30 seats, open only during business hours, and that's pretty much the only specific space that grad students have on this campus. So there's no graduate-specific lounge or bar. There's no conference rooms for graduate students. There's no meeting space for graduate students. There's limited social space and study space for graduate students in the individual departments if they choose to provide it. So this has been an issue with the University of Alberta GSA for quite some time. We raised it at the Board of Governors and at other university committees as well. And I think our argument has always been that if the institution wants to be recognized as one of the best universities in the country for graduate studies and compete with universities around the world, this is a feature that it has to have if it wants to compete with other institutions. So what the U of A GSA is doing is examining ourselves, what kind of services we can provide. So we recently moved into new offices in a new facility, vacating our previous offices, and we've actually formed a study group and a committee that's consulting with graduate students about the way we might redesign that space as a graduate student lounge, bar, coffee shop type type area. And so our strategy is to provide that kind of social space for graduate students and then continue to work with the administration to try to identify more academic or quiet study spaces and social spaces that could be integrated in other projects around campus. So then graduate students have a sort of a two-pronged approach when it comes to space. So that's pretty much what we're doing.
I just want to drill down to that a little bit. Mm-hmm. In terms of the kinds of activities that you could see graduate students are unique in a sense on campus because they do come from every discipline, and some are masters and some are PhD, sort of long-term residents and short-term residents. So can you just tell me a little bit some of the things you could see groups of students doing if there was space? It's kind of a chicken and egg question.
Yeah, sure. I think that that graduate students would make a lot of use of space of that kind. I think, first of all, we're just struggling with the reality that we live in a campus that's quite decentralized as an institution, so the departments are pretty separated from each other, and so there's not a lot of opportunities for graduate students to meet each other across disciplinary lines, and a common social space would hopefully encourage those kinds of interactions more often, and there's all kinds of benefits to that in terms of collaboration and networking and actually just meeting people.
Yeah, so do you see sort of little breakout rooms or teamwork space or, you know, kind of more coffee drinking space?
That was actually what I was going to say just after that. The sort of two pronged approach we have is we feel that because the institution isn't interested in itself operating other commercial bar lounge areas on campus, that we can step in and do that piece of it. That's the piece we're best centered to do. We feel like we are uniquely positioned to give students what they want in that regard, but we're hoping the institution will provide the other kinds of spaces that graduate students need in terms of large conference rooms, perhaps additional office space, maybe kitchens and things like that, because we have a lot of really dedicated, hardworking student groups on campus that really want that kind of space to host events that they're planning. We had a very spunky group in the music department that wanted to have an interdisciplinary conference for students of all disciplines that had some sort of musical relationship to it, and they actually wanted to have a concert jam session as sort of their closing finale for that conference.
Hope they invite me.
Yeah. Well, I could send you the invitation. I think it's already happened, actually, so it may be over. But they couldn't actually find a space to host that kind of event, and a lot of the spaces on campus just aren't. Either they're already booked by undergraduates, or they're out of the price range of a lot of graduate student groups. So I think our thought is that it needs to be a two-pronged or a dual approach, and the GSA is better positioned to provide one kind of specific social space, and the university is able to provide a different kind.
Now, if the university came up with space that would be suitable for sort of the academic team breakout room things, mm-hmm. would you see the university managing that, or the grad students, in a sense, like it's kind of mm-hmm. spontaneous use? I think part of it is that if you're working with a team or you're mm-hmm. planning something, you don't necessarily want to go to central booking and say, you know, 2 weeks from next Thursday, I need 20 minutes in a room. So mm-hmm. How would you see that playing out?
Well, actually, we've had some discussions with the university about integrating that kind of social space into some of the projects they're working on already. They're building a series of small graduate student residences, total 250 beds in our East Campus area of the university. And they had talked about putting in some dedicated graduate social space in the amenities complex that would serve.
Okay, I got to back up here.
Sure.
One sec. Does mm-hmm. that mean that you're going to get some housing that's specifically for graduate students?
That's right. Yeah.
Excellent.
That's actually been
tell us about it.
That's been something we've been working on for quite some time. So actually the most positive part of that news is that the project initially was a private-public partnership, the first of its kind for residents in Canada. So we were a little bit concerned about how that would work out, what the details would be. But because of the economic situation, it's actually just as affordable for the university to build it themselves now. So they're actually going to build the residents along the typical line. So we're very happy about that. But there was an idea of including a social space in that project and also within a possible physical activities campus complex we're building on campus as well. So the university's, I think, inclination is to have us administrate the space under their sort of supervision and provision. Okay. And that would, I think that works best for both partners.
So is the new graduate residence family friendly, or is it really what we would call a typical...
It's going to be family friendly
family
for sure.
Friendly?
Yep. It's apartment style. Actually, the building that was contemplated to also house graduate social space, that was on the top floor. The bottom floor was going to be a child development center. So, but now that they've switched direction...
I don't like this past tense here.
yeah, I was about to say that now that they've switched direction back to a non-private involvement, there's some questions about that building and what it'll look like, but we're still pushing for the same model. A social space at the top, child care development center at the bottom.
Okay, this is what you get in the land of oil. Let's see what we do in Ontario. So, Craig, do you want to tell us about Waterloo?
Yeah, so one of the things that's happening at Waterloo, we have our university's long-term plan calls for us to have 8,000 graduate students by 2017. We currently have 3,500, so that's a significant amount of growth. So there's going to be certainly a space crunch. As far as social space goes, we currently operate a grad house out of a farmhouse that was built in the 19th century, and we're very quickly outgrowing it. We're at the point where we have lineups of people waiting to get in because we're at capacity. So we're certainly looking at expanding on that front. There's also going to be a crunch, obviously, on office space. And another thing that is going to need to be expanded is grad student study space, because the thing about this growth is that most of it's not expected to happen in research-related degrees. It's expected to happen in professional or coursework degrees, and typically these aren't students who would be assigned an office, and it's probably more efficient as far as space goes to give them communal study space, and that's not something we have a lot of for grad students at Waterloo. Most of our study space is shared with the undergrads, so dedicated graduate study space is something we'd definitely be interested in.
So this is an argument that I get pushback on sometimes as well. Study space is study space. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the difference between a study space that's shared with undergraduates and study space that's really meant for graduate students.
Well, from the Waterloo perspective, I think part of the problem is that Waterloo has such a large undergraduate program that there's a perception that unless there's a reserved space for graduate students, then it's just going to automatically fill up immediately, just because there's so many undergraduates clamoring for study space. So I think that's the main impetus behind that. I know some grad students, if they're involved in a TA relationship, sometimes like to have a separate space just so that if there's a risk, they don't necessarily want to be working or socializing in the same space as people that they're teaching. Personally, I don't have a problem with that, but I can see how some people might feel not entirely comfortable with that. So that's another potential reason behind it.
But also, I would think if the graduate student has their TA hat on, that they would need to have sort of private space as well. So you'd need to have what I euphemistically call a breakout room of some kind, so they could do the mentoring in a spot where the undergraduate isn't just out in the middle of a bunch of people.
Yeah, that's true. Once a grad student's involved in a teaching role, they really need some kind of private space, even if it's an office that's shared with several other TAs, as long as there's a quiet place that they can go to discuss issues with their students, that's what's important.
Now, from the Nova Scotia perspective, it looks as though Ontario's just throwing money at graduate students, which I applaud. But how are you doing anything at Waterloo concretely about graduate space? Have they found space for you, dedicated money? Tell us about it.
Well, there's a lot of long-term capital expansion, and a lot of it does appear to be dedicated to grad student offices, so that's a positive step, I think. We're also looking at discussions with our own administration about building a new student services complex. The idea, the current situation is that a lot of our student services are spread out across the university, and we like to build some kind of one-stop student services building. And we'd be angling at getting a large portion, hopefully, of the space in that building that we could use to offer graduate student services by our association.
So what kind of services would you provide? What are you thinking of in terms of graduate students?
Well, the main services we provide are... I go through the list. We do a lot of social services, like running our grad house, restaurant and pub, social space. We also do a lot of services like a legal aid clinic, a tax aid clinic, which require things like meeting rooms.
Just for grad students?
We do that just for grad students, yeah. Those are some of the more space-intensive ones. We do a lot of services that aren't really space-intensive, so those probably don't pertain to the space.
Do you ever give, either one of you, seminars on professional development, like CV writing, taking an interview, project management, the kinds of things you're going to need the moment you get that degree in hand?
Our university offers some seminars like that, and they do them fairly well. So the philosophy we take is if the university is doing it well, we don't need to do it.
Excellent. How about in Alberta?
Professional development is sort of an issue that we have focused quite a lot on. So we also have a career and placement center that offers those kinds of seminars and services. So what we've done is entered into an arrangement with them where we subsidize a portion of the services to give grad students a discount. And so that's one area. We also have a professional development program that has about $100,000 in it. So grad students can actually apply for grants under that program to take courses available in the city of Edmonton or farther abroad, actually, if they need travel to a professional development opportunity or do they want to defray the cost of registering for something. So we do that, and we're actually looking at something a lot more ambitious now. We're putting $30,000 into a pilot project to start a professional development fund that will look at more sophisticated professional development projects, so maybe conferences on ethics and academic integrity, maybe defraying the cost or sponsoring students to take a certificate for teachers that's led by our university teaching services, so we would reduce the cost of that for a discrete number of students. So that's something that our vice president academic has made a big centerpiece of her term this year, and we're hoping it'll continue next term for sure.
Excellent. I'm all over that one. That's great. Okay, so I'm going to change the focus just a little bit because we've just come out of a session from SHRC talking about their new CGSs and the new budget infusion of the 400 masters in particular. So I'm going to start with Craig, just to be fair here. Do you want to give us some of your thinking on that?
Okay. Well, we've had a lot of concerns from our students about this new stipulation that was put on the SHRC, the new SHRC money that would be spent only on business-related degrees. Part of it comes from a general philosophical perspective that the more restrictions you place on where funding can go, the less efficient it tends to be distributed generally. For example, it's not like people who are currently in SHRC programs aren't doing relevant research. There are people who are currently doing business-related research, and it's getting funded. So it raises the question, why is this even necessary? The potential problem you would run into, for example, is if you can't find enough qualified applicants in that particular field, then you may be required to give some money to some less qualified applicants, for example, while some highly qualified applicants in a totally different field might get shut out. So that's part of the concern. It's important to note that the nature of our opposition to these kind of restrictions isn't specifically that we're anti-business. It's we're anti-meddling in research decisions. I would also oppose a stipulation. I think a couple years ago when after Al Gore's movie came out and made environmentalism very popular, I think you could have conceivably had a party that would have propose that every research project be in environmentalism. We consider that just as bad, even though environmentalism is a valid cause. The point being that, if the research is of high quality, it's going to get funded, and you don't need to put restrictions on it.
Mm. Okay, Ben.
Yes, I wouldn't. I wouldn't disagree with any of that. I suppose that I would echo the notion that there's been quite a lot of concern amongst our community about the decision on SHRC, and I don't think that our discomfort surrounding it is in any way anti-business or disparaging of business. The major issue that I've heard expressed from graduate students anyway is that there seems to be an assumption behind these kinds of funding decisions that somehow this kind of research is more quote-unquote useful than other types of research, that some types of research in the social sciences and the humanities don't have a societal input, and that's why should the taxpayer be funding them. And I think that's something that we would strenuously disagree with. So our organization has been committed to ensuring that there's a kind of funding equality, or at least fairness across disciplines. So the area we've been most concerned about this year has been the fine arts. We've actually gone to the provincial government with proposals for a scholarship for students in departments like music, drama, art and design, those kinds of things. So these kinds of decisions from SHRC strike us as a step backwards rather than a step forwards. But I guess I would have to say that the University of Alberta GSA is in an interesting position when it comes to federal granting agencies and federal issues, in that we're not really aligned or have a presence when it comes to federal issues. We're not a member of a national organization or even associated or connected with a national organization, somewhat on purpose. So it's a little bit difficult for the leadership of the association to figure out how to channel its views when it comes to decisions like this. So I've actually found the SHRC kerfuffle quite helpful in that regard, in raising the awareness of the fact that my association doesn't have to choose one organization or another, but it has to make some kind of decision somewhere about what its involvement and investment is going to be when it comes to federal politics.
So that does raise an interesting question of how do we get the message to the people who make these decisions. So to be fair to SHRC, it came from the government.
Yep.
It wasn't SHRC didn't wake up one night thinking, oh, this is a great idea. So just so, but that does mean that we have some responsibility in a sense of telling the story of the usefulness and the necessity of the SHRC disciplines to the economy and to the knowledge economy all the way up into the federal, because this is a federal level thing. So I'm going to put you two on the spot and say, okay, what is the compelling story here? What is the equivalent of saying we need a new Canada arm, we need electric car batteries? What can you give me a couple of good SHRC stories that I can take next week to Ottawa? I'll put Craig on the spot first. He's a mathematician.
Yeah, you're putting the mathematician on the spot for knowing some good examples of SHRC research.
Well, even math. Give me what I call the Globe and Mail story.
What's the Globe and Mail story?
It's, you know, you're going to explain to somebody who reads the Globe and Mail why we should be funding math. So then I'm giving Ben a moment to think about it.
All right. Well, my favorite story comes from a colegue. The kind of math that I do isn't really applied mathematics. It's more on the pure side. So one of my colleagues has a story that I like to explain why we do this fundamental research, why we do this research in pure mathematics. And he was having a debate with a physicist. So that's a debate between a pure mathematician and a very applied scientist. And the physicist was questioning the mathematician's research, and he was saying, why do you even bother doing any new research in math? All the math that we're using nowadays was developed 50 years ago. And my colleague's response to this was to say, well, 50 years from today, whose research do you think you're going to be using? So that's the very nature of research. I mean, if we knew where it was going, we wouldn't need to do research. The very nature of research is you don't know where it's going. So you have to conduct this research with the expectation that someday down the road, it will be applicable in some way.
And this is always my argument against only targeted funding, because what are you going to target the funding at if you're not doing the theoretical basic research in 5 years, we will run out of things to apply. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much. Okay, Ben, are you ready?
Well, I don't...
He's a politician.
That's right. So I'm going to say a lot of very elusive things that don't add up to very much. So I don't know. I guess the question I would have is I wouldn't want to enter into the discussion accepting the standard of usefulness that prevails in the sciences and the technology fields and engineering and those sorts of things. Because on that criteria, I mean, I think we've lost the game before we've even started. If we just sort of say, you know, how does the social sciences and the humanities and the fine arts, how do they benefit society like a microwave benefits society? I mean, we just can't compete on that method of assessment. But I mean, people who have advanced degrees in the social sciences and the humanities and to an extent the fine arts, they're in a variety of fields. I mean, they're administrators, they're counselors, they're involved in the civil service and in government, and they serve society in all kinds of very useful ways. And I just think that in a society that's becoming increasingly complex, we need the understanding that you can get from a social science humanities education to deal with some of, to be honest, the moral and ethical issues raised by our advancement in science and technology. So the two have to go hand in hand to a certain extent. I mean, let's not forget that in a balanced academy, even those who are in the hard sciences or the sciences are going to be taught a complement of social sciences and humanities courses.
We hope,
you know, and we'll make sure of that. So by people who have advanced degrees in those fields, and so if we don't support them, then they may not get to that point. So, I mean, so I guess I just feel like the benefits are everywhere when it comes to these sorts of disciplines, and they deserve to be supported. And I guess in Alberta, we're in a really difficult position when it comes to the SHRC situation, because unlike other provinces or jurisdictions, we don't have a provincial funding agency that supports the social sciences and the humanities and the arts, and that's something we've been trying to work on the government for as well. So anything that impacts the SHRC situation, I think, impacts Alberta quite a bit.
Well, I'm going to use Alberta as an example, because mm-hmm. you've got all this lovely oil, and your economy goes up and down. Mm-hmm. Nova Scotia just doesn't have fish, so it's kind of flat. But
Excellent.
Good. Anyway, so I can appreciate engineering innovation. I'm a computer scientist, so we get all of that. We're going to pump out oil. We're going to process it. We're going to send it. But you know, the social sciences have a lot to do with the impact on society. So what's the impact on society when the price of oil goes down? So it seems to me that in Alberta, you actually have some social issues that are directly related to the innovation that has to do with the energy sector. And so I'm not supposed to be making the case for you, but that's the case.
I wouldn't add too much to that because I think it's a very, very true comment. But I would also say that even when the economy is booming, there are social issues that result in terms of just infrastructure crunches and I mean the spread of money to certain communities in the province has also caused, for very unfortunate reasons, a rise in drug use and all that kind of stuff, and those are issues that can be tackled by research in the social sciences.
It also has an interesting effect on Newfoundland. Mm-hmm. So the economy here mm-hmm. has a reverse effect. So yes. When it goes down here, mm-hmm. it really goes down there because mm-hmm. I don't know if they're only men, but I see plane loads when I'm traveling of young men from Newfoundland coming out to Fort McMurray.
McMurray. The capital of Newfoundland, that's what people call it.
But now they're flying back, and so mm-hmm. that has a pretty negative effect back there. So anyway, I hope they cut this part of the interview. I'm not supposed to be talking. Okay, so what else can we talk about? Is there anything else you'd like your fellow graduate students to be thinking about?
I did some further comments on the relevance of social science and humanities research, and there does seem to be a big push that the popular research area seems to be technology, but this isn't entirely unrelated to social science research, because if you look at history, technological progress often forces or encourages social change. The internet's a big example, right? That is a major technological advance that fundamentally altered the way in which people interacted. So there's a lot of need for social science research that comes as a consequence of this technological research as well. One of my favorite examples is the Napster controversy of the 90s, when people were, once you had the technology to freely copy music, the record industry was afraid of, you know, going under, and a lot of this seemed to have to do with the fact that they didn't seem to have and this is sort of this raises political philosophical questions, because they didn't seem to have an appropriate notion of ownership that would permit them to fully take advantage of the new technology, and they essentially tried to use various means to pigeonhole it into the old notion of ownership. So that's a situation, I think, where we're having done some more philosophical thought on that might have come with a better way to address that situation than it was.
And we have no idea what the impact of Twitter and social networking is going to have on education and social interactions. Just none, zero, zippo, mm-hmm. including myself. So, Ben, you get the last word.
Last word? Okay, I guess maybe just if I were to make some final comments on any subject, I suppose that it makes perfect sense when we're talking about hot topics for graduate students in Canada that I sort of promote the reason we're here, which is a group, an organization of the 13 largest graduate associations across Canada, and they get together, I think, in a very novel sort of way. I mean, it's not a federation or an association. It's a group of autonomous associations without an advocacy purpose or a lobbying purpose. They don't pass votes. They don't pass motions. They don't take actual stances. What they do is they get together and debate a lot of the topics that we're debating right now. So the purpose of our several days together is to have discussions with the Tri-Council about the SHRC issue, amongst others, with some deans from across the country, about some issues going on in their institutions and their graduate schools, which is going to be very interesting, and to talk about some of the hot topics that we've raised today as well. So we have sessions on fees and funding and employment-related issues and student services and supervision and how that's handled in different institutions. And so I'd really want to pitch that this was a new initiative by McGill University last year. They did a great job. The U of A took a stab at it this year and it did the best that it could. And I really hope that it continues on next year and other schools take on the challenge of hosting it in the future, and that more administrators, more government officials will participate and support it in the years to come, because I think it's filling a gap that we really need when it comes to graduate associations in Canada and the important work that they do.
great last word. Anyway, I want to thank both of you very much, and I'm sure we'll all be hearing from you too as a mathematician and as a political scientist in the years to come. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode. If you'd like to get in touch with me about something you heard on this podcast or about an issue that you'd like to see covered, please email me at carolyn.waters@dal.ca. You can also leave a comment at the bottom of the page where this podcast is posted at universityaffairs.ca. Until next time, I'm Carolyn Waters, and thanks for listening.